Hi there, it's Jim Brown with another CaperCast. This is number 24, and Christy is standing right beside me with her stun gun, insisting that I place a retraction here. Back in number 21, when we were talking about racing, I said that that big deal French race that was going on, the Vendée Globe, was for fully crewed vessels. That's not true. It was for a whole tribe of single-handers. I also gave the impression that Ellen MacArthur was French. She's not. She was very British, but she's still a real honey in France. And all that says that I've got no business posing here as a historian because I can't see, I can't do any research. Heh, likely excuse. But if any of you would really like to try to keep up what's going on in the modern sailing world today, I suggest you subscribe to that Scuttlebutt thing. They'll send you an email every day, 5 days a week, so you can find out about all the races and finishes and other news. Sorry, but I spent enough time hunched over this machine to bring you the modern history and lore of lightweight seafaring since World War II. So I'll get on with it now, with a story from 1973 about how my family and I had the great opportunity to sail through the Panama Canal. Right, wind power. I left us last time crossing the Gulf of Panama, and I should explain that the isthmus in this area is really quite convoluted. I guess it's plate tectonics that have pushed things around enough so that the narrow strip of land joining North to South America is so twisted that the Panama Canal actually runs northwest-southeast. And I'd like to backtrack a little bit here to say that we also visited Coiba Island, which is located around the corner in the Gulf of Chiriquí. And this place is really a national park now, very beautiful. But back in those days, it was the site of the maximum security prison for Panama. And the unique thing about the place was that the prisoners, at least some of them, were allowed to run loose on the island. And at the same time, there was a small fishing resort there. It was just a few rooms and a few boats, but we heard that they tend to welcome visiting boats. So we went ashore there, had lunch in their very plain little dining room, and then walked up to visit with the prisoners, who lived in a cluster of little shacks. And right there was a little store that featured wares made by the prisoners. And there especially was an art form they called cortina, or curtains, that were comprised of strings of seashells. And these strings were suspended from an overhead bar, sort of like the beaded doorway. Although much finer, the shells were all of the same species, only about as big as a peanut. There were places on the island where these shells occurred naturally in great numbers, and the prisoners were allowed to go and collect them. Now, these little shells were of different colors, and they could make them into different colors by heating them and so forth. And then they would string these vertical columns of shells, locating the different colors along the strings so as to create an image. Right, when all the shells and all the strings hung vertically at rest, they would comprise a panel of whatever image the artist wished to create. But if you were to disturb the columns of strings by strumming them with your finger, you could get the image to move. And the prisoners sold this stuff in their little store in order to earn enough money to buy cigarettes and stuff. Well, we had to have one of those things to go along with our budding collection of Central American textiles. And the one we have, which is only about the size of, say, a road atlas, is the image of a butterfly. And when you strum the strings, it almost looks like the butterfly is flapping its wings. It's been hanging here in our place for 40 years, and it's still an attraction. They had one there that was as big as a door, and it was a square-rigged ship under sail. And if you strummed that one, you could see the sails billowing in the wind. And, oh, man, I wish we had bought that one. You know, there's always the artifact that got away, but they weren't cheap. But it was so interesting to see a prison run this way. There was no escaping from the island unless you had a boat. The surrounding waters are very rich in marine life, including sharks. And it's, I think, 20 miles from the mainland. And I've heard that since we were there, it has become quite a hellhole for a while, and now it's a national park. But we were able to contrast our visit to Isla Coiba with our visit to that California prison. I was able to get my whole family into a minimum security facility there at Lompoc, California, where I gave a slideshow to the inmates. I wanted very much for my sons to be able to see the inside of a prison. I think every middle school should have a field trip like that. But there I go again. I know, Christy, we're getting rather far afield from sailing through the Panama Canal. Here we go. Well, after that shameful altercation I had had with son Stephen over his sibling rivalry with Russ, and then to have it followed by that fabulous sail that Steve and I had that night. By the next afternoon, we had found ourselves a snug anchorage at the Perlas Islands, there in the approaches to the Panama Canal. And it turned out there was another sailboat in the anchorage, a small cruiser, and it was otherwise a very beautiful but rather lonely anchorage. And of course, the boys were always anxious to make contact with anybody who was doing what we were doing. So they got in the dinghy and went down there and had a visit and came back and said, "Hey, those folks want to meet you, Mom and Dad." Now this is just how serendipitous things can get. These people lived in Panama. She was the manager of the yacht club at Balboa, and he was working for the Panama Canal Company in marine traffic control. They were middle-aged. Their kids were grown and gone. But they apparently took a shine to the boys, and the next thing we knew, we had a choice mooring at the Balboa Yacht Club, and we were invited for a personal tour of the control tower at the first canal lock on the Pacific side. And the next thing we knew, we were up there looking down on a giant oil tanker being ushered through by donkey engines, and in the tower there was a working model of the lock itself. And Stephen was being directed as to how to throw the levers to open and close the gates to admit the ship through. I'm really ashamed to say that after 43 years, I don't remember those people's names. It seems like it was Bill and Marjorie. And they really opened our eyes about Panama. Bill explained that the canal is actually a very holistic, organic machine. Coming in through the Pacific side, as we did, one has to take two lockage steps up in order to get to the elevation of a big lake in the middle of the country called Gatun Lake. And there are several other lakes, man-made, up in the mountains that store water that discharges into the lake. This is fresh water now, rainwater, in the lake is discharged into the locks to raise and lower the ships. And there are two steps up on the Pacific side, about 60 feet in elevation each step, and only one step down on the Caribbean side. Right, the sea level in the Caribbean is much higher than it is on the Pacific side of that isthmus. It's because the Atlantic trade wind is blowing all the way from Africa and pushing that water into the Caribbean where it kind of can't get out until it squirts out through the Straits of Yucatan and the channel between the western end of Cuba and the Florida Keys, the Gulf Stream. And of course, that warm water squirts up all the way to the British Isles and Scandinavia. All right, Christy, there I go again. So we went through the rigmarole of a transit of the Panama Canal. There was a bit of paperwork and a few days of messing around. We had to get the boat measured for its cargo capacity, which was so small that our actual tariff for transiting the Panama Canal was $27. We had to put up a bond of several hundred, but we got it back because we didn't damage any of the locks. And I was told that we would have to maintain a speed of at least 6 knots, which was about twice as fast as our little 4-horsepower outboard motor would push us. So I arranged to rent a 25-horsepower outboard from a local fisherman. It was quite a job to get it installed on the little bracket on Scrimshaw's stern. Bill also took us down into the bowels underneath one of the control towers where we could see the electrical switches and mechanical linkages that opened and closed the valves on the huge underground pipes that brought water into the chambers of the locks. And during these several days that we were knocking around on the Balboa side, our kids made friends with some other kids, and the next thing we knew, we were in the backyard of a palatial home, enjoying a big family barbecue as guests of the president of the Panama Canal Company. And he was a very cool, regular guy. And while flipping hamburgers for everyone, he told me that There were several interesting things going on. First of all, Colombia, which is their neighbor to the south, was not at all pleased at having lost its most valuable possession. That is, the Isthmus of Panama was once Colombian territory, and the United States had formed a little coup in order to create the country of Panama so that it could make a deal with the locals for putting in the canal zone, American soil, so to speak. Also, they were having quite a problem some years with water supply. It took a lot of water to run all these ships up and down through their locks, so that between all the big ships and the little boats, they were stuffing as many craft in each lock as possible for each lockage. So we were going to be going through with tugs and tankers and other yachts. He also said that the ships were getting so big that there was barely a thin envelope of water around the hull of these ships as they passed through the locks. Again, this was 40 years ago, and he also said that they were considering building another canal through Nicaragua. A big lake in Nicaragua would provide much of the way, and also it could be done with just one lock instead of three, and they could make the chambers big enough to handle the bigger ships that were now having to go around Cape Horn because they couldn't fit through the Panama Canal. He also said they were even contemplating digging the new canal through Nicaragua with atomic explosions. They had it all figured out that with deep underground detonations, they could heave the dirt out of the trench and pile it up on one side, all in one operation. Well, we now know that that didn't happen. And in fact, since the canal zone has been returned to the Panamanians, they've gotten hot and built bigger locks. And with bigger locks and bigger ships, it seems to me it'd even take more rainwater. So who knows what's going to happen in a dry year. And we were also told that we had to have at least 6 people on board for line handling during our lockages. Well, we already had 4. The kids did qualify. So Bill and Marjorie offered to come with us. They told us it was going to be a long day, so we packed a big lunch. They also told us that we would be taking a Panamanian pilot on board who would ride through with us. Because of our friendship with Bill and Marjorie, we got clued in on a lot of what was going on. The canal zone, which was a 10-mile-wide strip on either side of the canal right through the middle of the country, was, strictly speaking, American territory. And it was set off from the rest of the country in a rather authoritarian manner. And many of the Americans who worked there never left the zone to visit Panama. Well, we did, and we found that Panama had a whole lot to offer. Getting on the schedule for taking our boat through gave us some extra time. So we traveled around and got the feeling that there are actually 5 different Panamas. First of all, there's a vast difference between the Pacific side and the Atlantic side. And then there seems to be a difference whether you are east or west of the canal. And then there was the zone itself. The differences seem to be both in climate and in geography, but also in culture. And we were yet to see the greatest cultural difference of all, that of the San Blas or Cuna Indians, who live on the Caribbean side and off toward the east of the canal zone. And our visit with the Cuna people is another story. We had yet to get into the Caribbean. But partly because of Bill and Marjorie, we really felt very positive about Panama. The place had a lot to offer, especially if you spoke a little Spanish. And before we ever rounded Punta Mala, we had also visited way up into the mountains on the western end of the country. We took the boat on a long river trip to a point where we could get the bus to go up into the mountains that really resembled, well, there was tropical vegetation around, but the rest of it looked to me like Montana or hard rock mining territory. And when comparing that with the San Blas Islands, my gosh, that's the Caribbean's answer to the South Pacific. There is a tremendous contrast all there within that little country. Another contrast I discovered was at the bar at the club in Balboa, where I bumped into a couple of guys that had made the same trip we had down from California in their West Sail 32, which is a very rugged but very ill-performing monohull. People really like a boat like that. They have a defensive attitude toward the sea and feel they should be sailing in a fortress. And they're good for northern waters and hard winds, so long as their engine works. And when these guys came around Punta Mala and the ocean started to shake their boat a bit, they promptly had engine failure and got blown way off down into South America toward Ecuador. They came very close to running out of food and water, had a rather desperate time getting back all the way up to the canal, where, of course, they had immediately put their boat for sale. They were drowning their sorrows in the bar. I felt so badly for them. And indeed, that's why the yachting crossroads of the world, places like Panama, Gibraltar, the Azores, and Cape Town, are always very good places to look to buy a used boat at a good price. People get their minds fried by the ocean through some unfortunate circumstance, like engine failure, and they just want to go home. Now, that never happened to us, and part of it was just plain luck, but also part of it was that Scrimshaw would glide along for miles under sail in a zephyr that wouldn't move a west sail 1 foot. Now, that's an exaggeration, but it's not an exaggeration to say that Scrimshaw would also creep into very shallow water, which gave us opportunities for real shelter in our anchorages. I think that has a great influence on one's cruising experience. I personally think that raw speed is not the real attraction to the multi-hull. Well, of course it is for racing, and that's where all the noise is made. But for traveling and living aboard, the real advantage to the multi-hull is its combination of those splendid seakeeping properties combined with shallow draft. The trade-off is in load-carrying ability. And if you turn your multi-hull into a barge, that's just what you'll have. And as we've seen recently with poor Lance Leonard, it was his condition of overload that had at least something to do with his losing his boat. An overloaded multi-hull is not safe. Well, there I go again, back to the story. Finally, the day came for us to change oceans. The mooring field for the Balboa Yacht Club is right at the entrance to the first lockage. The harbor launch brought everyone aboard, including our Panamanian pilot. We slipped the mooring, and the next thing I knew, I was driving my boat through a gate that was 60 feet high on both sides, almost twice as high as the top of our mast. And we were entering a huge concrete chamber with dripping walls, and it was 100 feet wide, like more than 5 times wider than our boat. And tied to the wall on each side of us, there was a big seagoing tug. And right in front of us, towering up much higher than the walls of the chamber, was the stern end of an oil tanker, the Petro Pan. I will never forget its name. That ship was so deep that in order to get through the canal, it had to be only partly loaded. So we were looking at the tops of the blades of its propeller. And those blades looked to us like they were at least as wide as a cabin in the pines, gleaming polished bronze. So we were directed to tie up to one of the tugboats on the port side of the chamber. And that meant that when the gate was closed and the water was starting to rise, we did not have to tend any dock lines. The tug would do that for us. But both Bill and the pilot seemed to be a bit concerned about our position because we were right behind the propeller of the tanker. Bill helped me double up on the bow line and the spring lines, which led way forward on the tug. I was soon to find out why. Those giant steel gates right behind us slowly closed, sealing off the chamber, and all at once the water's surface began to roil as the chamber was being filled by those huge conduits from beneath. But because we were tied to the tug, there was no difficulty. We were well fendered, and the tug was floating, so we just went up with the tug. And pretty soon, hey, we could see out over those 60-foot-high walls. But now our pilot was speaking on his handheld VHF radio with the captain of the tanker in front of us, saying, very deferentially now, he was a Panamanian in the employ of the canal company. He was definitely an underling, and he said, sir, When you move forward, can you please take it easy? We are right behind you in a little yacht. And the voice of the tanker's captain came back over the radio. What the hell did they put you there for? Why don't they put you somewhere else? We gotta get moving, you know. Well, they do have to get moving. They've got not only the weight of the ship and all of the cargo that has to move forward to get into the next chamber, but he also has that thin envelope of water around the ship. The chamber is 100 feet wide, and the ship is 95 feet wide. So running alongside both sides of the chamber, there's a cogged railway and little electric donkey engines, and they hook up 6 of those donkey engines to the ship with wire cable and start pulling on the ship. And of course the captain rings to the engine room, power, and so that propeller started to thrash, and I'll tell you, it was like going up Niagara Falls in a barrel. I was dumbfounded and helpless to do anything. If our bow line had broken, we would have been splatted against that gate right behind us. There would have been a pile of sticks floating in that chamber. Water was streaking over the decks. I'm sure the boat has never gone so fast, and as a matter of fact, I discovered later that our log, our little speedometer, which operated by a small propeller suspended from the bottom of the boat that twisted a cable like the speedometer on a car, it just broke the cable. So with 6 locomotives pulling on that ship and its propeller sucking water down alongside the ship through that thin envelope, the Petropan began to move. Thank God it finally moved ahead. We were okay. Everybody was wet. But the boat was okay, and you know, the crew on the tug was having a pretty good time over the whole thing. I don't know, maybe it was all done in the name of initiation, because when we arrived in the next chamber, they put both tugs on one side and put us on the other side up against the wall, so that for our next move, we were off to the side of the direct prop wash from the tanker. So we emerged from that lock and found ourselves 100 feet above sea level, entering a long channel through the hills. And now one begins to see the enormous effort it took to remove the cubic miles of earth to create a channel for us to get through into Lake Gatun. And as we started into this huge ditch, I asked the pilot how much speed he wanted, and he turned and looked at me and he said, "All you got." So I gave this 25 horse outboard a bit of throttle, and right away we realized we had a problem. This was the first time I had run it at anything more than a fast idle, and our little 4-horse had a very long shaft so as to get the propeller well down into the water. This 25 did not have that, and so all the propeller did was suck air from the surface. Well, I asked everyone to move back. You know, we had 7 people on board. We got them all on the stern and managed to get the propeller down deep enough to start down through the ditch. Already, the tanker was well ahead of us. Bill said that we had to stay with the tanker. So when we got to the Miraflores locks on the Caribbean side, we were supposed to be with the same company. Well, we went along like that, which seemed like a couple of hours. Beautiful tropical vegetation on both sides of the canal, but the motor was spinning its wheels mostly in air, and eventually we lost sight of the tanker. And all of a sudden, the motor quit. I checked the gas can and it was empty. Oh, I was mortified. Well, we had another gas can, but in my ignorance, I had no idea how much fuel a 25-horse outboard would use. We plugged in the other tank and continued, but by the time we got to Gatun Lake, I realized that we were going to run out of gas in the Panama Canal. Thinking of it now is funny. It's really funny, but at the time it wasn't funny. We got out into Gatun Lake and we had a piping breeze right on the nose. This was February. It's the time of year when most of the yacht traffic is coming the other way downwind. So as soon as we got into the chop of the lake, I turned to the pilot and I said, "Sir, we are going to have to sail." He looked at me with big eyes and he said, "You can't sail through the Panama Canal." The poor guy, he had really drawn some bad duty. I explained there was no alternative, And so the boys jumped to the halyards. We got the sails up, and the wind was hard on the nose. We started tacking up through Gatun Lake. Well, it's a big long lake, but it was originally a river, just a big swamp. And the canal is a big channel dredged down through this, and it's then dammed at both ends and flooded so that what you have on both sides of the channel is tree stumps sticking up out of the water. And the channel was at least 300 feet wide, but we were making short tacks going up here. And pretty soon, I hear this, whoop, it's a ship coming the other way. Here we are, tacking up against it. So the pilot was pulling his hair. I said, "That's okay, Captain, it's all right. When the ship gets close, we'll pull up the centerboard and sail off into the tree stumps." And that's just what we did. The ship went by, the crew gawking at us from the bridge. The pilot is on the radio trying to explain. Bill and Marjorie are rolling their eyes. The boys and I are quite excited with the challenge. And at times like this, Joanna just quietly observes. So it was mid-afternoon by the time we got to the end of Gatun Lake. And thank God we had Bill aboard. He was an employee of the Panama Canal Company, and he got on the radio and arranged for us to be able to pull up to a dock at the end of Gatun, something that is very discouraged. In fact, it's illegal as hell because of the contrabanding problem. Any vessel going through the canal is absolutely prohibited from making contact with the shore along the way because you could pick up drugs or people or whatever. And so we were really in a fix. And if Bill hadn't been there, it would have been deep yogurt. But he got on the radio, and we docked at a tug dock, and he grabbed a gas can and went ashore and hitchhiked to a gas station, brought back some fuel. Didn't take him long. But of course we had other ships and tugs go by us as we were waiting. There were signs all over that said, "Under no circumstances tie up to this dock." A little tug came in and tied up in front of us. The captain came back and spoke with our pilot, really chewed him out. Strictly speaking, we were to wait for a tow, and that would have been extremely expensive. So Bill really saved us from a definitely difficult situation. So then you go along through another ditch for a while and come out into another lake, a small lake, Miraflores Lake. At the far end of that, for us, that is the northern end, there was an empty chamber with its gate open. It was full, just waiting for us. We pulled in to the far forward end of the chamber, waited for a small freighter and some other traffic to pull in behind us. And now it became clear to me that, hey, I was going to come back to the Caribbean. While we were waiting there, I grabbed the binoculars and climbed the mast. We had steps on the mast. We climbed it often. I got up to the upper spreader where I could stand and look out upon the Caribbean Sea. For 18 years I had been trying to get back here. But what I saw gave me great pause. There was a stiff breeze blowing, and out beyond the giant breakwaters that protect that entrance to the canal, the Caribbean was really standing on its head. It was terribly rough out there, too rough for Scrimshaw to go to windward with its current load. But I thought, oh well, we'll just hang around in Panama for a while, let it blow down. Now Miraflores is a pretty place. There are little mountains on both sides of the canal. And tied up right there in the lake, there was an atomic ship, as they called it. A nuclear reactor in a ship, sitting to provide electricity for the Panama Canal Zone and for the rest of the entire country, all on a ship afloat in Miraflores Lake. I wonder if that thing is still there. And while I was on the spreader, there was a little electrical activity of another type over against one of the mountains. There was a little, afternoon thunder squall going on. It's quite a sight to see in the tropical mountains, the little sparks of lightning flashing back and forth between the clouds and the mountain peaks. This was not an approaching storm, it was just a little squall. Quite beautiful to see, actually, but all of a sudden, I heard some strange sounds emitting from the top of our mast. Zippity snap, crackle pop, zap zap, I came down. and I've later thought that it was a rare opportunity for me to see and hear a lightning rod at work. The top of Scrimshaw's mast is equipped with a 3/8-inch stainless steel rod about a foot long that sticks straight up, and the masthead light is fastened to the side of it. And there's a big telltale a weather vane up there that I can see from the deck. But the top of that rod is sharpened like the end of a pencil, and it's very sharp. I actually honed it and then polished the point with leather, because I had read that it is the sharpness of that point that allows an electrical, static electric charge on the boat to be dissipated gradually into the atmosphere so as to avoid a lightning strike on the boat. The purpose of a lightning rod is to avoid strikes, not to attract them and conduct them to the water. Although Scrimshaw's aluminum mast, which would be a very good conductor, and incidentally, lightning likes to travel down flat surfaces, and at the base of the mast we have a heavy conductor leading down into the centerboard trunk to a large chunk of bronze pipe that's fastened into the leading edge of the trunk in order to ground the vessel thoroughly. And there are also leads from the ends of all of the stainless steel rigging and chain plates that go to that same bronze pipe in the trunk. And the hope is that in the event that she is struck by lightning, there will be a path to the water without blowing holes in the boat. So the lightning protection business on a boat is to try to prevent a strike by dissipating the charge that naturally builds up on the boat passing through the water, and then in the event of a strike, actually provide a complete path to the water. And in the 40 years that I sailed that boat, there were several occasions when we were in lightning storms, especially in the Chesapeake, that you could actually see lightning hit the water and bounce, leaving a puff of steam. But Scrimshaw has never been hit. A lot of boats are damaged by lightning. Someday I'll have to tell you about how Mark Hassel got hit. And I'm going to get hit right now. Christy is picking up her stun gun. Back to the story. Well, basically, that's it. We spent a month there on the Cristobal Colon side of the Panama Canal, waiting for the weather to blow down. We moved the boat outside the zone around to a little Panamanian club where we were able to tie up and make some friends, had a good time, and went on with our Caribbean adventure, which we'll have to pick up at another time. This is my longest podcast yet. I'd like to hear from you as to whether you are enjoying the added length, okay? Please let me know. Until next time, then, sharpen your lightning rod. Bye-bye.